brethren, keep yourselves from idols. It's quite a striking way, isn't it, for John to end this letter. He doesn't wind things up with a doxology. He doesn't wind things up with a benediction. You might have expected something of that kind. He opts instead for this little sentence that's a whole mixture of things. For one thing, it's affectionate. Little children, there's warmth and feeling in that. For another thing, it's unsettling. Idols, that's a heavy, disturbing word that he uses. And for another thing, it's demanding. Keep yourselves from. A very definite behavioural response is being called for. So as I say, it's a striking conclusion that we have here. Where does it come from? Why does the apostle end his letter in this manner? Well, I think the answer is this sentence is fitting. It's fitting in relation to the letter as a whole, but it's also fitting in relation to the verses immediately preceding it, verses 18 to 20. Verse 21 effectively sums up verses 18 to 20. And for that reason, as we consider verses 18 to 21 this morning, we're going to make verse 21 our focal point. And I want to highlight then two things that are in it. I want to highlight the exposure, and I want to highlight the exhortation. The exposure and the exhortation. So first of all then, the exposure. The exposure. It's that word idols that's the most surprising feature of verse 21. It seems more suited, does it not, to a letter like 1 Corinthians. You remember how a big chunk of 1 Corinthians has to do with idol worship. Some of the Corinthian Christians, it seems, are still going along to the pagan temples. And Paul then, in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians, and also in chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, and also in chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, has to be emphatic and severe in his condemnation of what these Christians in the church are doing, so that it would be quite appropriate for that letter to finish on the subject of idols. But this letter? Are John's readers going along to the pagan temples? There's been no hint of it throughout all these five chapters. Has he only just now remembered that this is a pastoral issue that he needs to raise with these people? I've told you before about a friend of a friend who was doing his GCSE history exam and answering a question on Hitler. And wanting, obviously, to assess Hitler negatively, but also wanting to carefully follow the rules of an argumentative essay, he began with a few opposite considerations, a few positive things about Hitler, Hitler's love of animals, and the way in which he brought down unemployment in Germany, and a few things like that. Unfortunately, however, the lad didn't keep his eye on the clock. Time passed more quickly than he realized, so that he was still writing all these positive things about Hitler when the announcement was suddenly made, the exam is now over, please put down your pens. And as this wave of panic and despair engulfed him, he just had time to scribble down one last sentence, Hitler was also responsible for the Holocaust. And I'm asking then, is there among John's readers this glaring, outrageous problem? Sacrifices have been offered to pagan gods, and the apostle only manages to address the matter in one hastily scribbled down sentence right at the very end of his letter. That seems to me very unlikely. No, we lack any evidence of pagan practices going on among John's readers, but we have evidence of something that was going on. We know that John's readers had recently witnessed something. We talked about it last week, and indeed we've talked about it many times during this series. They had recently witnessed a bunch of people exit the Christian church. Remember John's solemn phrase in chapter 2, verse 19, they went out from us. And these people went out then, not because of their distinctive position on gifts of the Spirit, or baptism, or styles of worship, or the nature of the millennium. No, they went out of the church because they no longer held that Jesus Christ is God the Son.
eternally equal with the Father, the definitive revelation of God and the one apart from whom God cannot be known. It was rejecting all that that these people exited the church. John's readers, as I say, had recently witnessed that happen. They had recently witnessed these professing Christians adopt a new and quite different view of Jesus Christ. So back to our question then. Why the reference to idols here? If John isn't writing into a situation where pagan temples are being visited, but into a situation where professing Christians have been observed changing their view of Christ, then why use the I word? Is it just an attention-grabbing gimmick from John here? Is it clickbait? Why is idols a relevant word in this context? Well, this is why. These people, known to John and known to his readers, these people who have adopted a new and different view of Jesus Christ, they haven't merely exchanged one version of Christianity for another. No, John is saying here, they have exchanged Christianity itself for idols. It might not look like it. These people might not remotely resemble a stereotypical idol worshipper. They might look and sound very Christian still. They might speak our language regarding there being one God, and God being holy, and God creating and ruling over everything and all that kind of stuff. But John is saying that if that God they talk about doesn't have an eternal co-equal Son who became incarnate and died and in whom alone God can be known and experienced, then he isn't the living and true God. He isn't the living and true God. He's just another made up one to add to all the other made up gods in the world. He might as well be Artemis. He might as well be Aphrodite. He's in exactly the same man-made category. Verse 20 is key to bringing this out, where John writes, "And we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true." Now, the coming John mentions there and the giving us understanding John mentions there, they aren't two separate activities. This person John is talking about didn't come into the world and then, having come into the world by some other means, give us understanding. I mean, that's how it worked with the prophets, isn't it? The Old Testament prophets gave God's people understanding of God, didn't they? But they did so by doing something specific, by declaring or writing oracles. Thus says the Lord, dot, dot, dot. But here in verse 20, we have someone quite different. Here we have someone who is the Son of God, and is therefore in himself the radiance of God's glory and the exact imprint of his nature in the language of Hebrews 1:3. So that just by coming into the world, he necessarily reveals God. He doesn't reveal God when he clears his throat and says, "Thus says the Lord." He doesn't reveal God when he takes up his pen and writes an oracle. He reveals God simply in his person, simply because of who he is. And he reveals God definitively in a way that culminates and surpasses all other revelation of God. Which means then that if you downplay Christ's identity, as these people who had left the church recently were doing, if you say that he's not the eternal Son of God, then you are depriving yourself of the fullest and foremost unveiling of God that there is. You're depriving yourself of that proper understanding of God that can only be gained by gazing into his supreme and ultimate manifestation in the person of Jesus Christ. And without that proper understanding of God, then you can still talk a lot about God if you want, and you can still claim to be worshipping God in your gatherings, but your God won't be him who is true, to use John's language here. He'll be just an idol of your own making. Indeed, you can claim to have a deep union with God. But if that union isn't through being united to the eternal Son, then it isn't a union with Him who is true. We are in Him who is true, in His Son Jesus Christ, John says. Only the God known and experienced through His eternal Son. Only He is the true God and eternal life, as this verse ends. A God without an eternal Son through whom He's known and experienced just isn't the real one. You can call Him Yahweh if you like. You can call Him Elohim if you like. You can call Him all sorts of orthodox names if you like. But at the end of the day, a God who is not known and experienced through the eternal Son, Jesus Christ, is just an idol of your own making. And I hope you can see then why my heading is the exposure. John here is devastatingly exposing this downplaying of Christ for what it is. It's not a minor doctrinal deviation. It's idolatry, he says. It's idolatry. Without the highest possible view of Christ, and these people he has in mind no longer had the highest possible view of Christ, without that, you cannot be worshipping the true God. It's as simple as that. Verse 19 is also connected to all this. John's language there about the whole world lying in the evil one, which is what it literally says, not in the power of the evil one, just lying in the evil one. That language, I guess, sounds to our ears, conditioned as they no doubt are by the anti-supernaturalistic age in which we live, highly shocking. John's first readers, I suspect, would have immediately appreciated what it's about. In the Bible, Satan is, above all else, a deceiver. And indeed, Revelation 12, verse 9, uses a phrase very similar to the one here and refers to Satan as the deceiver of the whole world. Satan deceives the human race, and he does so with idols. Again and again in the Bible, a connection is made between idolatry and the satanic. You have it in Deuteronomy 32, verse 17, talking about Israel in the wilderness after the Exodus and the people's idolatrous ways during that period. It says they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known. You have it in Psalm 106, 36 to 37, talking about that same period of Israel's history. Again, they served their idols, it says, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. You have it perhaps more famously in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20. In the connection of the Lord's Supper that we're going to be celebrating today. Remember, Paul says, what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You have it in 2 Corinthians 6:15, where Paul is again condemning the practice of Christians visiting pagan temples. And in that context, he asks, what accord has Christ with Belial? Belial, of course, being a title of Satan's. And so we could go on with other texts in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you get the picture then. Satan deceives the human race through idols. That's how John's readers would have understood this reference to the whole world lying in the evil one. And they wouldn't have found that idea then in itself striking. What is striking, however, is the binary nature of John's outlook there in verse 19. Do you see that? According to John, there's us. We who believe that Jesus is the eternal Son of God, we who he says are from God. There's us on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there's the world in the grip of Satan's stupor, deceived by him into worshipping idols. There are just those two categories, aren't there, in verse 19? Just the two categories. There aren't three categories. So over here, there's the Hindus and the African ancestor worshippers that Patrick told us about on Wednesday evening, and the modern Western worshippers of money and of self. They're over there, and they're deceived by Satan then and worshipping idols. But then over here, you have orthodox worshippers of the eternal Son of God. Over here. But then in the middle, you have people like these guys who had left John's church, and you have the Jehovah's Witnesses, and you have all those so-called Christians in liberal churches up and down the land today who admire Jesus as an outstanding teacher and wisdom guru and example. And okay, their view of Christ leaves a bit to be desired. That's why they're not over here, but at least they're not over there. At least they're not deceived by Satan and worshipping idols. At least they're closer to us than the Hindus are and the African ancestor worshippers are and the worshippers of money and self. And John says, no. They're not even a little bit closer to us. They're over there too. Because there are only two categories at the end of the day, John is saying. There are those who recognize Jesus Christ to be the everlasting Word, the Father's only Son, God, manifestly seen and heard, and heaven's beloved one. And there are those who are Satan-deceived idol worshippers. And that's it. It's as simple as that. It's utterly binary. And you know, Satan doesn't care what kind of God, what kind of unreal God a person has. Certainly he's happy with ancestor worship. But he's equally happy with any cult or church where the Bible might even be read. But God is not known and experienced through his eternal Son, Jesus Christ. He's perfectly happy with that. It's quite a thought, that, isn't it? I don't know what you thought of that opening hymn that we sang this morning, Thou Art the Everlasting Word. Perhaps you thought, well, its tune could be a bit more catchy. Its language could be a bit more modern and clear. But whatever you thought of those things, I hope that the lofty, awesome view of Christ that that hymn expressed is your view of Christ. Because you see, that view of Christ is what distinguishes genuine Christianity from Satan-deceived idol worship. That view of Christ is the touchstone. Not belief in one God. Satan-deceived idol worshippers can have that. Not belief in a God who is transcendent and sovereign and holy and righteous. Self-deceived idol worshippers can have that. It's that exalted view of Jesus Christ that's the touchstone. How you regard Christ really, really, really matters. May all of us be on the right side of John's stark fault line there in verse 19. May we be those who believe in the eternal Son of God, not those who, deceived by idols, worship an idol. So, deceived by Satan, worship an idol of our own making. The exposure. But then notice with me, secondly, the exhortation. The exhortation. Because John doesn't just want his readers to see these people who had left the church in their true colours as idolaters. He doesn't just want that. He wants also, of course, to prevent his readers from going down that same route ever. Hence the exhortation. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. It's not just little children, they are idolaters, those people who have left. It's also, little children, keep yourselves. Keep yourselves from idols. And in that connection, it's important to understand what's going on in verse 18. Now, as you may have realized when I was reading the passage, I much prefer the New King James rendering of this verse, which begins then, we know that everyone who has been born of God does not sin. Now, John has said that kind of thing before, hasn't he? Back in chapter 3, you may remember that. But here I think he means something different. Here he's referring to a particular sin, the sin that he has just mentioned in verse 16, the sin that leads to death, as he puts it there. Remember what we said about that last week. We said the sin that leads to death is turning away from the central truths of the gospel that you once believed in. Apostasy, in a word. That's what these people who had left the church, that's what they had committed. And John is saying here then, in the beginning of verse 18, that everyone who is truly born again doesn't commit that sin. That is to say, everyone who is born again, truly born again, perseveres in the truth. But through what mechanism? Through what mechanism does every born-again person persevere in the truth? Well, this is where the middle part of verse 18 comes in. And again, then I'm going with the New King James here. We know that everyone who has been born of God does not sin, but he who was born of God protects himself. Now, only one word is different there from what we have in the ESV, but that one word, that one change makes for quite a significant difference in meaning, doesn't it? So the ESV rendering understands the one born of God in this line to be Christ. And he then protects the Christian from apostasy. The New King James rendering, on the other hand, it understands the one born of God to be the Christian. And the Christian protects himself, therefore, from apostasy. Now let me explain why I think the latter is the correct rendering. Some of the earliest of the Greek manuscripts available to us use the word him, as we have it in the ESV. Some of the earliest Greek manuscripts available to us use the word himself, as we have it in the New King James, and as I'm saying, I prefer. So which is better supported by the manuscripts? Well, it's impossible to decide. Therefore, for me, the crucial consideration is this. Is he who was born of God likely to be a description of Christ? I think the answer is no. Six times in this letter, up until this line, the phrase born of God has been used, and each time it's unambiguously a reference to the believer, to the Christian. And that makes it very unlikely that now suddenly the same phrase is a reference not to the believer anymore, but to Jesus Christ. And in fact, I don't think he who was born of God is even theologically possible as a reference to Jesus Christ. Christ was once born of the Virgin Mary, as we confess whenever we say the Apostles' Creed, but he was never born of God. He is the eternal Son of God. So it seems to me then that he who was born of God has to be a reference to the believer. And if he who was born of God is a reference to the believer, then it has to be protects himself. I mean, who else does the believer protect? It has to be he who is born of God protects himself. So I'm asking the question then, through what mechanism does the born again person persevere in the truth? And I'm saying the mechanism is through protecting himself. And as he protects himself then, Satan is thwarted in his attempts to deceive the believer and pull the believer into idolatry. The evil one, the last part of verse 18 says, does not touch him. Now, some of you may be feeling a little bit uncomfortable with this rendering and this interpretation that I'm giving you. But surely, Dan, you're thinking, it is Christ who protects us. You've told us that yourself so many times from this lectern. Including very recently, John 6:37, we looked at the other Sunday evening. Whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. And I said that cast out there is that figure of speech. What Christ is effectively saying is, whoever comes to me, I will always keep in. I will preserve, I will protect. So how can this verse then be teaching that we actually protect ourselves? Well, two things to say. First of all, the New Testament everywhere teaches both of these realities. Both of these realities. And the ultimate one, of course, the ultimate reality is that Christ protects us from the evil one who wants to deceive us and make us apostates. That's the ultimate reality. But Christ does that through our self-protecting efforts. Which leads me to the second thing to say, which is this. It's actually, it seems to me, part of the dignity of salvation that Christ doesn't protect us in this way, by means of us being these floppy puppets on the end of a string. And whenever Satan comes anywhere near us to devour us, he has to quickly kind of pull the string to get us away from Satan as soon as possible. No, Christ protects us by making us strong and resilient. People who can, in the language of James 4 verse 7, resist the devil so that he flees from us. He doesn't simply flee from seeing behind us the one who's protecting us. He flees from us, James says. And you can detect this concept here, actually. Who is the one who protects himself? Well, John says it's the one born of God. Surely that's saying to us that we don't protect ourselves from the evil one through some natural capability of ours. No, we have had this supernatural birth, which has furnished us with supernatural abilities. Born of God, we now have the life of God in our souls. That's how we can stand up to the devil and resist apostasy and keep ourselves from idols. One of my favorite descriptions of a Christian in the whole Bible, I think, is in Colossians chapter 1, verse 11. What is a Christian? Well, that verse says a Christian is someone strengthened with all power according to his glorious might for all endurance. A Christian is someone strengthened with all power for all endurance. Is our endurance Christ's work? Yes, ultimately, of course, it is. But not immediately, but mediately. That is to say, he gives us the strength to endure. He gives us the resilience to withstand the enemy's temptations. It's what we sang a moment ago. There with the ransomed throng who prays forever, the love that made them strong to serve forever. We're made strong to serve Christ, by Christ. That is to say, we endure by God's strength, certainly, but not by God's strength simply acting upon us while we are those floppy puppets I talked about, rather by God's strength entering into us and making us strong and robust men and women. So, believer, are you taking seriously this exhortation, therefore, to protect yourself, to keep yourself from idols? Early on in this series, I mentioned a couple of times a man who used to be part of this church and apparently a very keen Christian who no longer today has a high view of Jesus Christ. Now he spends his time on Facebook trying to discredit Christianity as much as he possibly can. And this morning then, you're sitting in the seats where he once sat. Don't follow him in that tragic course that he took from sitting in these seats to eventually shipwrecking his faith. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. Amen.